1-1 pitch. Hit hard, high, center field. Awfully deep. Saunders turns at the wall, looks, and it's gone! Mark DeRosa! Into the batter's eye in dead center field. A three-run bomb. It is 7-2 Blue Jays.
Back on May 5th, Mark DeRosa's second home run of the season gave the Blue Jays a 7-2 lead on the way to a 10-2 win, backing an outstanding outing from Brandon Morrow. That was the 95th home run of Mark DeRosa's career, and he joins us on the Blue Jay A Day pregame show. Phone lines are open if you want to talk to Mark at 416-870-0590, star 590 on the cell, long distance, 1-888-666-0590. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you being with us, and we appreciate your time. And the first thing I got to say is, hearing that clip, I apologize if I sounded surprised that you hit it into the batter's eye in center field. I should have known better from watching you in spring training.
I just like your energy and the call. I mean, what was that, June, early June?
Now that was May 5th, and the team was 10-21.
Oh, my God, yeah, you were grasping at straws trying to find something. But, no, I get it. I totally get it. I surprised myself with a couple balls this year, too.
Seven home runs this season after hitting one in the three previous years where you played a total of about 120 games. You said it right there that you surprised yourself, but you were a different guy and much more like the 30-year-old Mark DeRosa than the 35-year-old this year.
I don't want to sound, too confident, but I always knew I got hurt in 2009, and I got hurt bad, and I knew it, and I tried to play through it for St. Louis. And I probably did more damage than I should have done. And it cost me a good 2 or 3 years. And this was the first year I could honestly say before I got to spring training where I was hitting in the off season a couple times and really felt like, hey, I feel pretty strong and the ball seems to be coming off a lot better. So let's just see what happens. And that's kind of what I did going into spring. But I never doubted if I was healthy, whether or not I could be productive. It was just a matter of being in pain for so long and just kind of succumbing to the fact that, hey, maybe this is going to be the way I go out.
And it must be thrilling that you know that that's not how you're going out or hopefully it's not over, but you stick around for a while. But that must have been, and you talked about this in the spring and during the season as well, and I mentioned at the beginning how much of a go-to guy you were for us all season long, and we really tried not to go to the well too often, but it was so hard not to because you had great stuff every time we came to talk to you. But how difficult it must have been for you to get traded over to the St. Louis Cardinals at the deadline in 2009 to move into a pennant race and get hurt almost immediately. And you know, and this is a team that was, you know, they wanted you, they were counting on you, and it must have been really tough for you to there's no way you're going to say, hey, I can't play like a week in.
Yeah, and then to have to hide it for the majority of the time there and just kind of bite your lip and deal with being a subpar player on the offensive side. And you know, there's very few times in your life that change your life. And I remember driving home from St. Louis after the day I did hurt my wrist. I can remember the swing I did it on, the pitch, everything. And I called my father and I said, what do you think I should do? I think I did some serious damage here. And he said, I think you should shut it down and have surgery. And, you know, I know you feel obligated to this organization. They traded people away, but at the end of the day, this has got to be about you. And being the team guy that I always wanted to be and I think got me to this point in my career, I wanted to find a way to gut it out, and I probably should have just listened to my dad at that point. So it ended up costing me a long time on the DL and having a lot of people look at me a little differently than I would have liked throughout the course of those 3 years, and not truly believe everything that goes into wrist injury. So, you know, I think for me, watching what Jose Bautista went through and then watching what Mark Teixeira went through kind of gives validity to how bad I was hurt. So I knew it. I probably should have done what dear old dad told me to do, but I didn't. And that was what was refreshing about coming back and not doing great by any stretch of the imagination in Toronto, but feeling like if a pitcher made a mistake, I could change the score of the game.
Well, you certainly did that, and you came up with some awfully big ones, too. The home run in San Diego stands out, the one you wrapped around the right field foul pole in Tampa Bay, and proudly wearing your Oppo Taco T-shirt after that one.
Yeah.
You know,
I think the one that sticks out for me was Canada Day. I thought that was a great kind of put the game on ice, but not only that, there's just a great atmosphere at the ballpark, and to be able to do it on that day I thought was pretty cool.
That's your first Canada Day here. It must have been kind of special. And you were the cleanup hitter that day.
I didn't bode well for the Toronto Blue Jays when I had to hit cleanup. I'd never hit cleanup in my career. And, you know, I actually, funny story, I got a text from about 5 or 10 past players. They were like, D-Row, you didn't hit cleanup when you could actually hit. And now you're hitting cleanup in the AL East. So, yeah, it was one of those things we found ourselves, and Gibby found himself having to put some lineups out there that none of us would have imagined coming out of spring training.
No, that's the absolute truth. I'll tell you this, though. You did have more RBIs out of the cleanup spot this year than out of any other spot you hit in the lineup. See these wonderful things we can find out with technology.
That's what you're supposed to do.
That's right. That's what a cleanup hitter is for. We're with Mark DeRosa, and he's taking calls. The lines are open at 416-870-0590, *590 on the cell. Long distance is 1-888-666-0590. I asked you in spring training about your history as a guy whose teams make the playoffs, because teams that you're on make the playoffs all the damn time. And you told me, basically, I'm no dummy. I follow the pitching. And that's what brought you to Toronto, but things just didn't work out here this year.
No, they didn't. And you know what's funny is I was sitting in Arizona in September with Brandon Morrow and Ricky Romero on either side of me, and just kind of, you know, you rehash on the bench what we could have done differently or what could have gone differently. And you know, I turned to them. I said, "You realize you guys are." are two of the biggest reasons, and through no fault of their own, but it's tough when you lose two-thirds, I mean, of your rotation by the middle of May. It left our coaching staff in a tough spot. It left our GM in a tough spot. It just leaves you in a tough spot. RA and Burley obviously didn't get off to the starts they are used to getting off to, but they rebounded and battled. I thought they did a heck of a job, both of them. What Mark Burley's been able to do is in his career can never be questioned. What RA was able to battle through and kind of, you know, he's throwing a trick pitch. It's not an actual pitch. I mean, some days it's going to work and some days it's not. And for him to pitch in the AL East and to be as effective as he was, I thought was an advantage for us. But when you lose Brandon Morrow, Ricky Romero, J.A. Happ, Josh Johnson, that was the, for me, if there was one fluke to the entire Toronto Blue Jays season, it was Josh Johnson, because I faced Josh Johnson multiple times, and for him to have one win, and to pitch with the chance to make $100 million contract and all the things that come with it, he would have been the number one free agent out on the market. A lot of us, myself included, I felt terrible for him to watch him go through what he went through after the great spring he had. And I completely believe that any team that gets this guy, whether it be Toronto next year or if he goes somewhere else, will get one of the better pitchers in the game. I don't know if he'll ever recapture his early glory that he had, but anything close to that, any team would love to have. So that one was surprising.
Do you know, by the way, what your career OPS against Josh Johnson is?
I know I hit a homer off him, which I told him repeatedly. So,
and that
I
was your know. Only official at bat. You walked every other time you faced him.
There we go.
So it's 5,000. You own Josh Johnson. But back to the whole everything you were just talking about there, and again, spring training was so everyone was so excited and all this stuff. If someone had said to you, Mark, this year the Blue Jays are going to get out of Josh Johnson, Brandon Morrow, and Ricky Romero 4 wins, what would you have said?
Yeah, we're going to finish in last place.
Yeah, that's it.
You just not in the, you can't compete on a nightly basis without arms. And you know, I sit back and I watch all these games and stuff, and I look at a team like Baltimore. They're a perfect example of a team that their pitching's kind of holding that offense back. I feel like, not that their pitching's not strong, but when you look at the rotations that are being run out there in this postseason, Baltimore's lineup stacked up against anybody's mm-hmm. in the game, and it could be one of the top 2, top 3 in the game. So the game always comes down to pitching. It always does. I hate saying that because it's such a – you put so much pressure on the pitching staff. And I'm not a pitcher, so I don't want to take the emphasis off the position players. You got to do the fundamental things right and catch the ball and score some runs. But at the end of the day, when you got guys on the hill that can shut down the other team, you got a chance to do special things. And we have the guys. We had the talent. I think, you know, that was the thing. We lost Jose Reyes for months. We lost Brett for months. We lost Bautista at the end. Tough when you're running out lineups that no one predicted us to run out.
It was certainly tough top to bottom. But what kind of taste did it leave, though? I mean, you've got the Blue Jays have an option on your services. Obviously, you have the same option, you know, you're going to be 39 years old and you can say, well, I've had enough, but what's your feeling?
I don't know if I'll ever have enough, to be honest, Mike. I don't think you lose that. I said that to my wife. I said, when I'm 45, 50 years old, I'll still think I can go up there and get a hit. I think that's what gets you to that point. I know talent plays a huge role in it, but I think that inner fire is what separates guys at that level.
But when you're 45, you'll either be managing or hopefully you'll be up in the booth with me, one or the other.
Well, I think, you know, it's a situation where I'm going to wait. The Blue Jays have, I think it's 3 days after the World Series to pick up the option or decide what they're going to do. So it's kind of up to them. And once I know what direction they're going in, you know, with regards to me, then I'll sit down and make a decision, but it's definitely nice being home. It's definitely nice being with the kids. Obviously, I'd love to be playing in the postseason right now, but either way, it's going to work out. That's the way I look at it.
Home is Jersey for you, so I have to tell you the big story.
Original
here,
home is Jersey,
right? Original. Where are you now? Florida.
15 years. Atlanta. 15 years. I've been in Atlanta.
Because all those Braves guys wind up.
All those Braves.
Yeah. But original home is Jersey. And you know, you give love a bad name has never been louder mm-hmm. at the Rogers Center than when you're walking up. So I don't know if you know, but a story that's been around here this last week is that at Air Canada Center, there's a banner, a new banner is going up with all the Leafs don't really retire numbers. They only have 2 retired numbers, but they have a bunch of honorees and all the Stanley Cup banners and, you know, the tens of thousands of NBA championships that the Toronto Raptors have won. But going up there in the rafters is John Bon Jovi. Actually, I think it's the whole band. Bon Jovi is getting a banner because they've played that arena more than anybody else.
I'll tell you a funny story. It's one of the greatest nights of my life. I'll make it quick. In Tampa, I always celebrate my birthday in spring training. My wife flew down, and Bon Jovi was playing in Tampa that night. And we went. And afterwards, my wife says, I have a surprise for you.
Come on.
Okay. Yeah, oh, yeah. We went backstage. We were the only people to go backstage. They didn't bring – there wasn't a meet-and-greet session. And we went back, and I got to talk to him for about 10, 15 minutes. And I don't remember much of what I said because I was completely starstruck. But he seemed to know an awful lot about the Toronto area and seemed to love it and was asking me about the Blue Jays and everything. So, yeah, he definitely is liked being up there. And that doesn't surprise me that they would put his banner up.
That's very, very cool that you had that moment. And Starstruck is hilarious because, you know, people meet you and it's the same way. But every professional athlete wants to be a rock star, and every rock star wants to be a professional athlete.
You know, when I first got to the big leagues, I was starstruck to walk into our own clubhouse with Greg Maddux and Smoltz and Glavin and Chipper and all those guys. And then once you become teammates with them and you get a few big hits, you start to realize they're just normal guys like everyone else. But there's you know, a certain few guys, Bruce Springsteen, you know, John Bon Jovi, guys that I grew up kind of shaped my adolescence, so to speak. So to meet him, the guy who wrote Living on a Prayer and wrote all these songs that I listened to my whole life, was pretty cool.
I can imagine. It's not happened. But on my end, but I certainly can imagine. We are with Mark DeRosa. We're going to step away for a second. And as is always the process here on the Blue Jay A Day pregame show, second segment is way less of me, way more of you. We have a couple of lines still open. People waiting to talk to Mark DeRosa, 416-870-0590. *590 on the cell, long distance, 1-888-666-0590. It is the Blue Jay A Day pregame show ahead of Game 5 of the World Series. Here on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Mark DeRosa stands in to lead off the second and belts one to left. That's gone. Hello, Mark DeRosa. First pitch home run into the Blue Jays bullpen in left, his seventh. Then the Astros lead is cut to 4-2.
The 100th home run of Mark DeRosa's career came July 27th. And that was on Hall of Fame weekend. I had the honor of calling that one, too. And Mark DeRosa is with us here. And we said it back then, but especially given what you went through over the last 3 years. I mean, congratulations on getting to 100 homers.
Yeah, I always said that was a number that players talk about. I mean, obviously, with the 500 homers and the six, those guys are immortalized. But to hit 100 homers in the big league says, for me, it says pitchers had to execute. You hung around long enough to hit a few big home runs and to have pitchers grind to get you out. So I always looked at it as a nice number of longevity and also a guy that could, like I said, change the scoreboard from time to time. So, yeah, it was a number I wanted to get to. I didn't think I would get there. I was sitting on, 93 for the better part of 2.5 years. And I just knew with the way I was taking BP and with the way I was hitting the ball in the game, I just knew it probably wasn't going to happen. So to come the spring and to be able to get seven balls out, I would have liked to have hit a lot more, but it's a nice round number I'm pretty proud of.
And you should be. We're with Mark DeRosa here. Before we get to the phones, I have to say we're talking about you meeting Bon Jovi, and I was reminded over Twitter that I did get to interview Paul Simon. He came up to the booth for a post game this year after he enjoyed a Blue Jay game. So I've had my brush with greatness too, but a little bit different, those two guys, for sure.
It's funny you say that because he was sitting right by our deck circle.
That's how we found him.
I said to Brett Laurie, I said, Brett, you see that guy right there?
No idea.
And he had no idea who he was. So times have definitely changed. Maybe that's my cue that I'm getting a little old.
I don't think relying on Brett Laurie's pre-1990 pop culture references are any of that. I promise less of me and more of the callers, so I will come through. A lot of people want to talk to you. We're going to start with Rommel. Is that right? It's Rommel. That's much better. Rommel in Brampton, listening on our flagship station, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Say hello to Mark DeRosa.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
What's going on, man?
Nothing much. I just actually wanted to ask you a couple quick questions. First one up was, I know usually you're a man of the postseason, so how does it feel to have an extra long off season?
You know, it's only happened two other times in my career, and it's always weird for me to pack my stuff up on the last day and leave. So, yeah, I think, you know, like I said in the earlier segments, we had so many injuries, things just didn't go our way that kind of were relegated to the fact that we were going home there pretty much in August.
Here's a question, because it came out during a day or two after the series that someone, an unnamed Blue Jay, kind of said that he was disappointed by how many guys weren't around at the end of the season. I mean, Colby Rasmus had surgery, and Edwin Encarnacion had surgery, and Rajay Davis had to go have a baby. But there were a whole bunch of guys, a half dozen or so, who I don't want to say checked out early, because that's kind of been my experience. I've only been around the Blue Jays, and when guys can't play, they often go home late in the season before it's over. But what were your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's frustrating. I mean, you could look at it one of two ways. Are you getting this interference I'm getting?
I'm not.
Oh,
maybe a little bit of a crackle or something, but
oh, there we go. Now we're good. Yeah, you look at it one of two ways. We were out of it so early, I felt, in August, that you knew in September the young guys were going to come, and you had to see what the younger guys had to offer. The Anthony Gosses and the Ryan Goings, Kevin Pillar, all these young guys that came up are going to get an opportunity to play on a team that's not going to the postseason. Would I have liked to have seen some guys grind some stuff out? Yeah, of course, but then again, I'm not inside their body. So I grinded my wrist thing out, and it cost me 3 years of my career. So I tread lightly when I talk about stuff like that. I'm a little different. I think football has made me that way. I grew up playing it, and you play through stuff until – you know, you can't anymore, and surgery is the only option. That being said, you know, Brandon Morrow's dealt with the injury issue for a while now in his career, and something that he's going to have to find a way to grind through if he's going to take that next step into being that counted-on ace that everybody thinks he can be, myself included. A guy like Brett Cecil had such a miraculous year. You know, he doesn't want to jeopardize anything going forward. So everybody had different scenarios for why it happens. But at the end of the day, I always tell myself I'm not inside their body to really make a judgment on it.
But not even playing. And I'm not talking about playing. I'm just talking about hanging around. Staying with the team till the end of the season. That was what the comments were about, I think.
I think for what I learned about the Blue Jays organization is that's the way they do things. If you're not an active player on the active roster, you're headed to Dunedin to get your rehab and your stuff in. And you know, if you can't help us going forward, then you're probably not going to be back with the team. So that's kind of an organizational thing that I don't necessarily agree with, but you know, that's the way they do it.
All right. Well, with Mark DeRosa taking your calls, Francis is in Fort Erie. Francis, you're on with Mark DeRosa.
Thanks for having me. You know, now with the expectations of the team being so high, I want to ask, in the clubhouse, like, what did the leaders do to try to turn this around? Did they do enough? Are there enough leaders? And you kind of alluded to it as well. Did guys just plain give up or just went through the motion? You know, just, I know it's a stat-driven sport. They're just looking after the best own interests.
You know, I think the biggest misnomer in the game is that the best players on your team have to be your leaders. I think I've played on enough teams to know that it's not necessarily the Greg Maddoxes of the world and the Albert Pujolses of the world that are the leaders behind the scenes. Definitely they lead by example, and those are the guys you try and emulate and try and follow and see what they do, but I mean, we did more than the fans probably even realized, to try and keep that clubhouse as together as we could with as much injuries as we had and as bad of a start as we got off to. I remember calling an early meeting in New York after getting swept in New York and just kind of asking people to air out all their differences and to kind of let's build some kind of common bond. But that clubhouse stayed strong for as bad as, I don't want to say as bad as we played, but for as much as we underachieved, the clubhouse never was lost. There was never any animosity towards anybody in the clubhouse. There was never any difference of opinion that wasn't aired publicly amongst the guys. So we stayed as strong as we could. I know that's not the answer you're looking for. I wish it could have been better, but at the end of the day, I think there are some guys that need to step up vocally. But I also think there were some guys this year that spoke in those meetings that I didn't think would. And I think the team will be better off for it. And as far as quitting on it, I'll allude to what I said before. I don't know what other people feel as far as pain threshold goes. But I've always been taught to go until you can't go no more. So, you know, that's the only way that's how I was raised and that's how I've approached it. Whether that's right or wrong, you know, I'll leave that up to other people to answer.
This may be too easy to answer without having to be really, really introspective about it, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because when you talk about keeping a clubhouse together, and you see the Latin guys hang out on their part and the English-speaking guys there, but, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, because you speak each other's language, but having Munenori Kawasaki there, he really did seem to bridge all the cliques and the gaps and all of that stuff.
Outside of numbers, taking statistics, Munenori Kawasaki meant more to that team this year than anyone on that roster. And that's 100% truth. That guy came in, breath of fresh air, having to take over for one of the best players in the game. And the things that he was able to do, and I know the fans really loved on him for the energy and the way he went about his craft and his interviews and everything that went along with Mooney and just his fun-loving attitude. But his ability to work in AB, his ability to get a bunt down, to move a runner, to do everything fundamentally solid, my hope would be that he's bought himself some more time in the big leagues. I would hope that. I don't know what his contract status is or where he goes from here, but he can play in the big leagues. There's no doubt about it. And what he meant to us as far as, like you said, bridging the gap in the clubhouse was immeasurable.
It was amazing to me that he used Esmiel Rogers as his English translator. That's what I found like the best part of Munenori Kawasaki.
We had a great clubhouse. I'll say that. We did have a great clubhouse. It's tough when you guys are going down and you're losing and it's not going the way it's supposed to go. It's easy to lose people. And, I thought for the most part we kept it as good as we could.
With Mark DeRosa, more calls. Josh in Thornhill. Josh, you're on.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, no problem.
My whole life to speak to an actual MLB baseball player to ask this question, so here it goes. The Blue Jays do not have a dirt infield. All the 29 other teams do. What impact would you say on a scale of 1 to 5, maybe, would it be to disadvantage our team because we practice in our spring trainings on a dirt infield, all our other games are in a dirt infield, and we have young players that are coming up in the ranks that play with a dirt infield, and when it comes to the majors, there's no dirt infield. So how do you find that disadvantages the team, or doesn't?
You know what, man? That's a great question. It affected me more than I thought. It took me... First off, let me say I didn't expect to be playing as much as I did early on. With
right,
Brett
you were
Lurie
half a third
down.
Baseman for the first 2 months of the season.
It affected me almost to the point of a good month, month and a half to find out where I needed to play on the turf to not only make up for lack of range because the ball was getting on you so quick, but also the seams that were in the turf that would create bad hops that no one could really see unless you were walking out on the turf. So, yeah, I think it does negatively impact us. I always look at it as a visiting player. You come in as a visiting player. I played in Toronto numerous times. And you come in and you just deal with it for 3 or 4 days. You know it's a great place to hit. You know you're probably going to get some balls that find holes. And you just kind of deal with whatever the defensive side you get that series. But when you're on there every day, and I think Emilio Bonifacio fell victim to it too as well. And it took us a while. It took myself, Meisser, even Reyes, and then when he came back with his ankle not being 100%, you could tell his range was completely diminished and was having trouble getting balls up the middle. So, yeah, I think it's, I don't know what you can do about it. I know they've talked about eventually going to grass in there, but I think a smart thing to do or something that should be talked about is maybe making the spring training field a turf field if they're going to keep it turf. Just something that where you can use it to your our advantage, the Blue Jays' advantage, instead of it being almost an impact on us for the first month or two of the season because we had so many new guys. So, yeah, it did play with my mind a little bit for a while.
Would a dirt infield like they have in Tampa help?
I think so. I think so. It's what you're used to playing on. Not to say Tampa's field is great by any stretch, because I don't think, you know, I love being on grass, and that's the way I think the game's supposed to be played. I understand why the Rogers Center is turf with the amount of stuff they do there, but I didn't even think about it when I signed. And then when I got to Toronto and was taking ground balls, you still don't think about it. And then game speed kind of hits, and you're like, wait a second. I got to move further back to create more range side to side, but yet I can't go too far back to where I can't reach first base. So you found yourself in some obscure positions from time to time.
Got time for one more call. Malcolm is in Gatineau, Quebec. Malcolm, say hello to Mark DeRosa.
Hi, Mark. I'll tell you this. I'm starstruck talking to you. Never mind Bon Jovi. But I would like to ask you this as a hitter. I mean, there seem to be problems with, I know Jerry pointed them out, of impatience at the plate by some of the guys. And, you know, I think I have a bit of an idea what a tough out is. But last night in the game, I heard the term a productive out. And I wonder if there's a difference, and could you explain that? And can it be taught?
I mean, for me, I feel like, you know, I always tried to – I followed Chipper Jones around like a puppy my first 5-6 years in Atlanta, watching video with him, seeing how he went about his business, and just tried to – every time I was on a new team, the best player, I just kind of tried to pick his brain. What's he sitting on? Even the pitchers. What would you throw in this count? What? Why? And formulate game plans. So I think that's made me a tough out as I've gotten, you know, played in my career. But as far as having productive outs, for me, productive outs are taking pitchers deep in counts. Maybe you make an out, but you make John Lester burn 10 pitches. Man on second, nobody out, and you hit a ground ball to second base. Yeah, you would have liked to have gotten a base hit, but you did your job. And I think in the AL sometimes, I don't want to say it gets lost, but it's just a different brand of ball. In the National League, that stuff matters because you have outs at the bottom of your lineup. Usually the 8-hole hitter, the 9-hole hitter is the pitcher. Usually there's a couple outs that pitchers will be able to massage their way through, maybe an inning and a third more, or maybe 2 innings more that they wouldn't get that far in the American League if they were facing 9 straight hitters. So I think being a tough hitter and being a productive hitter, productive outs are, you know, like I said, outs that help the team in the long run, or put guys in scoring position, or you know, doing your job, man on third, less than two outs, ground out to second base. You don't need to hit a sac fly to save your batting average. Ground out, be 0 for 1 and get the ribby and get your team the lead. So that's what I think when they talk about making productive outs.
Right. Guys like you and Munenori Kawasaki, those are two tough outs, even though you both only hit about 235 this season.
Yeah, I always look at on-base percentage, how many times. You know, I look at OPS. Those are big numbers for me. If I have an OPS off the bench of over 700, I feel like I'm doing my job.
You had an OPS as a pinch hitter this year of 924.
Yeah, I was, you know, everything that I needed to do or what I was signed up to do, I felt like I did very well. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that upset me is I didn't know if I was going to be playing. And when I got the call, it was January 15th, 20th. I mean, you got a month to go until spring training opens up. I felt like had I prepared like I normally do, going into a season, and I didn't because I didn't know if the phone would ring. I kind of just stayed active. I would have liked to have been in better physical shape to do all the things that you need to do on an everyday basis to be an everyday player because of the injuries to Lori, because, you know, I was relegated to sometimes playing second base, and I played a heck of a lot more than I don't want to say I didn't prepare, but I played a lot more early than I thought I was going to. And, you know, shame on me for that, but when you hit 180 with no homers and your wrist is hanging on, and I kind of figured that was the end, so I didn't think I needed to grind it out the way I normally did, and, you know, you find a way.
It is understandable. We're out of time. I would keep you, I've said this to you a million times in the season, I keep you here forever, but and I'm sure you've had enough too, but we do appreciate your time so much. The one thing we always do before we let a guy go is we take a look deep inside the numbers, and I've told you a couple of numbers already that were pretty impressive about you this season, but one that you might not know, and we played a first pitch homer that you hit earlier. When you put the first pitch in play this season, you hit 519. So sitting in attack mode seemed to work awfully well for you.
You know what? I had no idea of that. Like I say, I'll go to the plate with an idea of what I want to do and how I envision it working. And, you know, if I get that first pitch, it's a situation where I feel like it's a guy I handle. You know, I'm definitely... The only reason I'd ambush a guy like Justin Verlander is because he's got a nasty curveball working that day, and I don't want to get to that pitch. But for the most part, when I'm swinging early, I usually feel pretty confident about the matchup.
And the numbers certainly bear that out. Mark, thank you so much for your time, not just tonight, but all year and during the spring. I really appreciated it a whole lot. Hope to see you back next spring, and I'm going to get you up there in a spring training game to do color with me because it's going to be awesome. Have a wonderful winter, and again, I hope you're back, and I hope we get to see you.
All right. Thank you for having me. It was awesome.
My pleasure. Mark DeRosa, if this was our last Blue Jay a day this season, that's how you finish it. Now you know why we all ran to Mark DeRosa pretty much every day to talk to this guy about baseball. Just an amazing, amazing hour with him. The ball game is coming up. It's the Sportsnet Radio Network.